Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Right on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Renee Gerlich. She's a feminist writer and activist based in the Wellington region, New Zealand. You can follow her writing at reneejg.net. So first, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek. Thank you very much for inviting me.
So recently there has been some controversy over Pride March in New Zealand that may lead us to some explorations of some problems on the left.
So it's somewhat difficult to explain. But what's happened is that there's sort of this long-standing relationship between the Pride Parade members and organisers, and a group in New Zealand called People Against Prisons Aotearoa, who are a group of prison abolitionists who also, you know, don't like the Department of Corrections or the police very much. And the Pride marches, or the Pride parades, started up in New Zealand in 2013. And then in 2014, that was the first year where the police participated in uniforms. And PAPA, People Against Prisons, they were obviously really upset about that. And so the following year, they showed up with a big banner saying no pride in prisons. And they confronted police and security at the march. Actually, the leader of the group, Emmy Rafferty, got his arm broken in the process. And so what's happened this year is that the police submitted their application to join the 2019 event. I think they must have done that around September. And then a meeting was convened in October among Pride organisers, and PAPA was there, and they were very adamant about their position about this police application and that they, you know, the police shouldn't be allowed to participate. And as a result of that, the Pride Board in November announced a decision that they were going to ban police from marching in uniform. And that decision has had a kind of ripple effect, which has also led to, you know, the conversation about transgenderism and so-called TERFs, particularly lesbian feminists, and whether they should be allowed at Pride. And the whole palaver has kind of sucked in quite a lot of sort of political commentators or media representatives and politicians who might have otherwise preferred to stay away from the issue. So it's been quite huge.
So what are the arguments put forward by all sides? Why? I mean, I understand that that people who believe in prison abolition may not particularly want to rub shoulders with police officers, but I thought that the point of the Pride Parade was actually having to do with homosexuality and not with prison abolition. But maybe I'm misunderstanding.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, it's quite noticeable in New Zealand that the commentary about it is very confused. That the New Zealand public seems to be trying to grapple with exactly these questions, what is going on. Because the prison abolitionists, like PAPA, they kind of advertise themselves as being hard left. So, and you know, so they're anti-police, they're anti-prisons, they're anti kind of state authority, and it's kind of hard to reconcile with their support for a pride parade, which is ultimately a corporate event. But so one of the things that they argue is that they want to return Pride to its kind of radical Stonewall roots, and they talk about, you know, that history of Stonewall, where And it, you know, but this was a time, as you say, that homosexuality was criminalized, and so you know, there were police raids on gay bars frequently and things like that. So, you know, and Stonewall, that was a police raid on a gay bar where a lesbian feminist store maid delivery sort of led this uprising against the police. So it's interesting that this group Papa is alluding to that to justify what they're doing, because, you know, as you say, like, Pride is now supposed to be an event around celebrating the decriminalization of homosexuality, and also Papa doesn't actually do a lot at all to talk about, you know, gay rights. So when you look at their lobbying and their work and their demands, they have these 50 prison abolitionist demands, which provide a lot of context for this argument. And a lot of those are around prisoners who identify as transgender, and specifically and realistically who we're talking about with that is we're talking about men who identify as women. In New Zealand, there's about 10,000 male prisoners and 800 female inmates. And we also know that in the general population, you know, most people who identify as the opposite sex are men. So we're talking about men. And one of the reasons why Papa is so upset with the police and with corrections has to do with the rehousing of men who identify as women into women's prisons. They want to, you know, facilitate that and, you know, ensure that there aren't any restrictions around that. And the interesting thing is that the only real restriction at the moment in New Zealand on men being placed in women's prisons, if that's what they prefer, is if they're sex offenders. That's the only real obstacle. So it kind of means that, you know, I think the group that Papa, that their work, you know, best kind of represents is male sex offenders who identify as women, and there does happen to be a number of them in New Zealand. Malcolm Platt, Pierre Parsons, you can look up these cases. So, you know, so for me, one of the big questions that's being raised with this whole palaver around Pride is around, you know, what is Pride really about? And it seems to me that Pride is really about, you know, male sexual license. I think that's quite evident, you know, when you go and I went at the beginning of this year, and you go and you see adult men dressed in baby onesies and running around in G-strings and straps and whatever. So you know, that raises a question around, like, why some people might not want the police to be present and on duty. But yes, one other thing that's happened is that since the announcement was made, another meeting has been called, November the 18th, where there was a politician present who is kind of acts as a liaison in a way between, she's a lesbian, and so she's a big promoter of you know, diversity, LGBTQI politics, and sort of acts as a liaison between the sort of Pride and that community and the police and government. She's the one who actually passed, it was her bill that legalized same-sex marriage in New Zealand. So she turned up to this meeting, and given her relationship with police, would have probably been expected to express some support for them, because a lot of people found the decision to ban the uniforms objectionable. There was a show of hands at this meeting she was at that suggested, you know, around 3/4 of the people present opposed the decision to ban police uniforms. So she was in a tricky position where she didn't want to override the board, but she didn't actually personally, she wasn't comfortable with their ban on the police uniforms. And so she said, well, actually, my whole thing is that I don't want any turfs at the Pride Parade, and not knowing that she was being recorded by a feminist in the audience. The following day, actually, as a result of the ban on police uniforms, all the corporate funders started withdrawing from Pride. So, you know, there's three big banks who have taken their money out, and New Zealand Media Entertainment, you know, all the big money is basically gone. And so they left crowdfunding and, you know, dealing with all this controversy around the police, but also, you know, now this quote-unquote turfs issue. And it has created such a mess, Derek.
So this is a pattern that we have seen at Pride marches around the world, or Pride parades around the world, where lesbians are increasingly being excluded or, in some cases, assaulted. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah.
Which seems really weird to me, to be excluding lesbians from a Pride march. That strikes me as odd.
Yeah, it's absolutely obscene. And then also yesterday something else happened that kind of has, you know, escalated the whole situation here too, which is that a wonderful lesbian feminist journalist called Rachel Stewart wrote an article in the Herald, which is one of our biggest newspapers. And it was in response to having heard the recording of Louisa Wall exclaiming, you know, no, I don't want any turfs at the Pride Parade. And so she wrote this article, and it was actually the first article that I've seen that has actually come out in New Zealand media, which basically calls bullshit on transgenderism at all. Like, so far, there have been a few articles which offer a critical perspective within a piece that will also, you know, be sympathetic towards trans politics, but we haven't had anything quite like this. So that, I mean, it was the number one trending thing on New Zealand Twitter yesterday. And so, yeah, and so there are a lot of people who are now weighing into this question about whether, you know, lesbians who don't accept men as women, and therefore, because they have to confront this issue, because they've got these men trying to enter lesbian organizations and lesbian circles because they identify as lesbian and they want to date lesbian women and things like that. So these lesbians have to contend with us and take a position. And so, you know,
let's be clear.
Sorry.
I was just going to say, let's be clear for people who might not be following this issue very closely.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that lesbians are being demonized for not wanting to have sex with people, with penises.
Men, yeah.
Am I correct so far?
Yes.
Which I would think that wanting to not have sex with someone who has a penis is kind of part of the definition of being lesbian, is it not?
Absolutely. Yeah, you would think that that was pretty uncontroversial, but apparently not. Yeah. I mean, I feel like we're almost seeing some sort of de facto recriminalization of lesbianism just in time for Pride 2019 in New Zealand. Because, you know, since Louisa Wall's, you know, I think I did mention that she's a Labour Party politician in government. So since she made this exclamation and has been questioned about it in the media, her response has been to dig her heels in. So now she's making it clearer and clearer that she really doesn't think that these lesbians, you know, who don't accept men as women, should be able to come to the Pride Parade. And she's actually more adamant about that. You know, she did an interview on Radio New Zealand and they asked her how she felt about the police uniform ban. She said she was very disappointed about that ban because the police are doing so well and they've just won this diversity award and they've got this new rainbow car and, you know, just about all the police who graduate from the police college now have a rainbow lanyard, you know. And she was asked how she felt about all the corporates leaving, and she actually said it made her feel sad because she said we've lost what Pride is all about. But on this issue of lesbian feminists, or to be fair to her, who she calls TERFs, there's really no question in her mind that, you know, they shouldn't be allowed. So it really, for me, because all of these different groups who are involved in this supposed controversy, you know, whether it's the Pride Board, which was run until July, I think, by a man who is in his 60s and calls himself Dykey Girl. He blogs as Dykey Girl, so he identifies as a lesbian. And then
which means, by the way, that he is a male who has sex with women, which 15 years ago would have made him a heterosexual.
Yeah. Pride has been overrun by these heterosexual men, yes, and their interests, you know. I mean, I don't know how the numbers would break down if you went to a Pride parade and you surveyed people how many of them are actually turn out to be heterosexual men. I would say probably most. But in any case, it's their interests who have, you know, the interests of men who identify as lesbian have overrun the Pride parade. But the interesting thing is that you've got all these parties in conflict or appearing to be in conflict. But the police have completely conceded to this movement themselves, and they, you know, in their media responses to this ban, they seem so bewildered, you know, like they're like, but we've got rainbows everywhere, and you know, why won't you let us join in? And then the prison abolitionists as well, so Emmy Rakete, who I mentioned before, who runs this group, People Against Prisons Aotearoa, is also a man who identifies as a lesbian. So, you know, I think, you know, the only justification that he has in terms of making public statements to not want the police at the parade is not because they're not doing what's being asked of them. They are. I mean, in 2015... Papa protested to have a man who identifies as a woman moved to a women's prison, and corrections complied within hours of the request being made. And, you know, so it's almost like this idea that they have this really antagonistic relationship with the police. It's kind of, it's almost a bit staged, because it actually looks to be quite cooperative in many ways. But one thing about the Pride Parade being all about male sexual license, I mean, when you see it that way, and it's quite clear, it's quite apparent, I mean, it, you know, just go and look at it or Google Pride photos and you can see what Pride is about. And I think that, you know, when you look at it that way, it becomes clear why some people wouldn't want on-duty police in big numbers in the parade, you know, because that can be put limits on male sexual license, can't it? But they're even more adamant and insistent that they don't want lesbian feminists or any feminists who are opposed to the phallocentrism of Pride in general They're definitely not allowed because we're the biggest party poopers and we're also much easier to target. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like this whole farce of Pride is kind of being exposed at the moment.
So we can stay on this subject if you want, but I kind of want to move to an essay you wrote. Well, I want to say something about prison abolition, and then I want to mention an essay you wrote called "Me Too and the Call for Restorative Justice: Are They Compatible?"
Okay.
Or we can stay here if you want. But I'll just mention that when I used to teach at a prison, I taught at a supermax security prison for, I don't know, 5-6 years. And all of my students at the prison, many of whom were doing life in prison, they were all pretty adamantly opposed to prison abolition because they said, if you're not, there are some people who need to be removed from society. And there were, most of my students, frankly, were, if you kept them off drugs, they would have been okay people. You know, they had killed somebody in a drug deal gone bad or, you know, some other circumstance. But as they said, if you want to abolish prisons, you're going to end up with a lot of murders and rapists, even more murders and rapists on the street than are already there. It's not... Anyway, I wanted to give that perspective from my students who actually were in prison. And then, so, do you want to talk about, I mean, this is something that we hear a lot from the sort of anarchist perspective as a push for, quote, restorative justice. And do you want to talk about that at all, the relationship between between men's violence against women and calls for restorative justice? Or would you rather go back and talk about Pride more?
No, we can talk about this. Yeah. And yeah, it's interesting. I have a lot of respect actually for the prison abolition movement. The real prison abolition movement. You know, not without reservations, obviously, but I think if you read people like Angela Davis, you know, she wrote a text called "Are Prisons Obsolete?" And she makes a very good point about how, you know, we see prisons as inevitable, but they're only sort of a recent, they only sort of emerged at the same time as the Industrial Revolution. And then she connects prisons to capitalism and talks about things like after the abolition of slavery in the United States, you know, it wasn't a coincidence that black people started to be incarcerated and were doing labor in the prisons. And, you know, now we're seeing this phenomenon of prison privatization. In New Zealand, we have a prison abolitionist called Moana Jackson, who's Maori and does a lot of work, you know, talking about prison abolition and decolonization and the extremely high rates of Maori who are incarcerated in New Zealand. And he talks about how imprisonment doesn't reduce reoffending and all of those things. And absolutely, all of that needs to be taken seriously. But I think that if you are genuinely concerned about all of those issues, then you're prison abolition comes from a place, you know, is anti-violence, and you know that would suggest that, you know, to go with your critique of the prison system, you need to have an analysis of male violence and how that's going to be addressed if not through incarceration. Which is something that feminists are really concerned about and don't for a second believe is addressed with all these, you know, airy-fairy restorative justice projects, which, you know, involve things like one-on-one discussions with a mediator between a victim and a perpetrator with the idea that, you know, somehow this little chat is going to bring closure, or I don't know. Like, I
Well,
find it.
in addition, a lot of psychologists have written about how, especially when you have someone who is abusive, when a couple where the man is abusing the woman go into couples counseling, oftentimes it's a complete disaster for a woman, for the woman, for the victim, because the perpetrator is quite often quite able to make, they're quite often very manipulative, and they will often, especially with an inexperienced or not very good counselor, be able to rope the counselor into their side. And so quite
Yeah.
often, or I was talking to this woman a while back about restorative justice circles within an anarchist community, and she was saying that what would happen is that she got sexually assaulted, and then instead of, she couldn't go to the cops because they were like, oh, then you'll be a snitch, and instead she had to sit in a circle with the perpetrator and re-describe the sexual assault, and then in front of everybody, and then she ended up basically getting re-traumatized, re-offended is how she called it, by the entire group basically gaslighting her and making it ending up being her fault.
Yeah, and then the question is, how is this so much better than the court processes that we currently have? You know, like these prison abolitionists and restorative justice advocates, you know, I often talk about the importance of community-based projects. Julie Bindle recently wrote an article about how she thinks that juries have no place on rape trials because, you know, we understand, and most self-identified leftists are supposed to understand at the moment that we live in a rape culture, meaning that most people carry around a lot of sexist ideas about women and about how rape happens. And so, you know, if you can't trust a jury, then how can you trust a so-called community, and do we even really have those in this society that we live in? Yeah, I mean, and then, but then what you have with these closed rooms, I mean, I just did a short sort of free online course through Victoria University on restorative justice, and noticed, you know, they show these video reenactments of how the meetings work, and in one of them, one of the mediators made a real point of saying, you know, I'm going to tear up these notes at the end of the meeting, so don't worry. So the point was that, you know, it's private and it's not on record. But then where's the accountability? Because at least now with the court system, you know, there's the court, you know, you can hold, you know, there's some public accountability. You can't have that if everything's happening behind closed doors and then the notes are shredded. And so I actually find that the whole idea of restorative justice highly intimidating.
There's part of my problem with it is that there are strains within anarchism, and there are certainly strains within queer theory that push for the transgression of all social norms. And that I believe that there are social norms that should be transgressed, such as we should not stand by while those in power declare war on Yemen, you know, or that we can come up with all sorts of social rules that should be transgressed. But again, and this is not me just saying this, this is sort of standard mainline queer theory, is that all social rules should be transgressed, which is how queer theory ends up supporting things like pedophilia. And my part of my argument about that is, even if you live in Nazi Germany, there's no reason to sexually assault a child. You know, even if you live in this horribly oppressive regime.
Yeah.
And so the point coming back here is that I fully recognize the racist and oppressive nature of prisons, but at the same time, something that is ignored by a lot of people who push for this restorative justice, or a lot of anarchists in general and a lot of queer theorists in general, is that if somebody violated rules very severely among some traditional indigenous people, I know that the Dakota, for example, if somebody would consistently violate the rules, they would banish the person, which is they would kick them out of the society completely. And that's the point, is that there must be some form of consequence for actions. I want to tell one more story real quick, which is about there was a strong Tibetan community, people who had moved from Tibet to the United States, in a small town in New England, and they found that one of the males had beaten his wife, and they didn't go to the court system. Instead, all of the Tibetan people in this community declared that person to no longer exist. So if they saw him in a grocery store, they would avert their eyes and they would put their hand over their face so they couldn't see him. The yeah. point being that he was completely exiled from the community.
Yeah.
Anyway, so just take, go anywhere you want from that.
And yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, yeah, I mean, if you're going to advocate the abolition of prisons, you need to have a compelling alternative around how we're going to secure accountability from perpetrators. And, you know, even with suggestions like, in New Zealand, people often talk about prison abolitionists constantly leverage the fact that Māori didn't have prisons, and that, as part of a decolonization program, we should honor that and use indigenous methods. But neither did Māori have, prostitution, or for that matter, male lesbians. So we're going to have a way to, there's going to have to be some social transformation. You can't just decide to ignore that and start implementing processes that, that don't address all of that stuff. So yeah, but
they also didn't have automobiles, and they didn't have school zones either.
I mean, it's just completely ridiculous. Yeah.
As long as you have automobiles and school zones, you shouldn't be able to drive 120 yeah. miles per hour while you're drunk. I mean,
it's like a decolonization program that doesn't actually acknowledge that colonization has taken place.
So I want to say one more thing about this, which is that I was talking to someone a few years ago who was a police abolitionist, and they were trying to get people in poor neighborhoods of especially African American people to try to agree to this project where they would try to abolish the police force in the community, and they had no success whatsoever. And the reason they had no success, they realized pretty quickly, is because the police are not the only threat to the people. And yeah. there are armed gangs who are often better armed and more highly organized than the cops.
Yeah.
And so what she realized is that before they could even think about prison abolition, they had to come up with an alternative that would actually protect people and convince the people that this was a better protection system than the police. There had to be an alternative in place that would actually protect them from the armed gangs.
Mm. And then, yeah, that kind of, because when I look at things like prison abolitionist groups, and I think, I have respect for that movement in its truest form, but my issue with it is the same issue that I have with just about every so-called leftist movement or organization that there is that they've all liberalized. So part of what I think that leads to is that, to me, it's kind of leading to a lot of leftists, just about everything they do is about advocating for men who are not served by the conservative right. So their whole thing is about, you know, you mentioned gang violence. I mean, there's a woman in New Zealand who runs a platform called Action Station, which is quite a moderate reformist sort of petition platform. But she's also a prison abolitionist, and she's in the media reasonably often discussing her views. It's really interesting because she's going quite hard at the moment trying to shut up feminists like myself. And Rachel Stewart, who I just mentioned, wrote this article in the New Zealand Herald. So she treats us as kind of like this extremely dangerous threat to the country because, you know, like if we're allowed to speak, then we're going to cause all this violence against trans-identified people and suicides and things like that. But if you hear her talk about prisons, she likes to say that victims and perpetrators are the same people, i.e. that, you know, the 10,000 men who are incarcerated in New Zealand should be perceived as victims. So, and I think that's really typical of liberals when it comes to all sorts of things. You're not allowed to question Islam, which is a very patriarchal, you know, misogynist religion, because Muslim men are subjected to racism from, you know, conservative authorities in the West, and, you know, to, and they protect these and men who identify as women, and they will justify gang violence as being a result of, you know, colonization, even if that's not, you know, really the full story. And they will justify terrorism as being a result of American imperialism. So it ends up being that you've got this whole political paradigm which is so absorbed in rationalizing and justifying the actions of men who are persecuted by the conservative right, that they start losing any sort of analysis of violence and male violence that makes sense. And that's partly what I think is leading to this whole mess at the moment.
Part of the problem, it seems to me, is that what are forgotten in so many of these discussions are women.
Yeah.
And what are forgotten, and where I come in with my primary issue of environmental stuff, is that it's the same with the land, that the land is always, when people talk about social justice, they forget the land.
Yeah.
And when a lot of men talk about social justice, they forget the women. And, you know, we talk about you know, the argument for putting males into women's prisons is that they are scared in the males' prisons, oftentimes.
Yeah.
That's the argument.
Yeah.
But no mention is made of the women who are now forced to share their spaces with males, which includes, I mean, there have been women in prison who already have been raped by males who have been put in cells with them. And that's the same argument happens with all these bathroom bills, that supposedly that the males are afraid to go in bathrooms with other men, and so then who takes up the slack? Well, then they have to go into bathrooms with women, and now the women are the ones who have to be in the bathrooms with men. And I don't understand, if it's a problem of male violence in the first place, why do women have to pay the price for it?
Exactly. And one of the, you know, one illustration.
And that's hate speech. And that's hate speech to simply say that.
Yeah, it is.
Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
No, like one of the big illustrations to me of how crazy this double standard is that Papa, who I've been talking about, one of the things that they like to refer to as being one of the unacceptable practices of the of corrections that they want ended before they would, for instance, let the police or corrections anywhere near the Pride Parade, is that the practice of strip searching inmates. So they like to talk about how so-called trans prisoners, who, you know, we know they're talking about men who identify as women, get strip searched, and that this is a real violation of their rights and dignity. But you know, you can tell this group until you're blue in the face that there have actually already been 6 assaults in New Zealand in women's prisons committed by trans offenders placed in women's prisons, who, you know, there's most of whom are men. There's 6 of them in New Zealand. It's they will be all men. I mean, there's the corrections is being very evasive about stating their sex, which is a pain. But you know, there's every likelihood that those 6 trans prisoners in women's prisons are a male. So a strip search is an inexcusable violation of the rights of a male prisoner who identifies as a woman. But, you know, if he rapes a female inmate, we don't even have to discuss that. We don't have to talk about Karen White and what's just happened in the UK. When a man was rehoused and placed in a women's prison and attacked 4 women within days, you know, that just gets written off as an anomaly. And it's like, well, if you believe that that's an anomaly, you haven't been listening to women, because, you know, we've been talking about these men for quite some time. But yes, it's just crazy.
So this is kind of off topic, but if they're not going to do strip searches, and this is just like a technical question, really, I know that, again, when I used to teach at a prison, they were strip searched and cavity searched not infrequently, because I hate to say it, but the behind is a pretty standard place to hide things. My students, actually, there's a term for it. They called it packing the trunk, you know, to put anything from drugs or weapons, anything, cell phones, I don't know how they fit up there, but... I'm not advocating explicitly for stripper cavity searches, but I don't understand if you're going to have a prison, it seems that at this point is, since that's used as a method of transportation, it seems that there has to be some other way around it then.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a legitimate question. Like when you're a prison abolitionist and your understanding of prisons, you know, has you conclude that they're ultimately, you know, it's another violation. Like the system isn't set up to, you know, it's not a social justice system. It's a system which, you know, is based on violation in many ways. And so if that's your understanding, then obviously you wouldn't then also believe that the strip searches were done, they were an exception, and that, you know, that they're done, you know, purely out of necessity and have nothing to do with you know, violating and dehumanizing inmates and maintaining that sort of power and control dynamic. But yeah, I mean, it's true, like, you know, you can't let people smuggle weapons or something into prison.
So let's go back. We have about 10 minutes left, and what are some of the larger lessons? You know, that's how we started, is by saying that this pride Oh, there's one thing I want to say before that, which is one of the reasons that we hear the word inclusive a lot these days, and it always strikes me as pretty extraordinary that one of the reasons that women are supposed to allow men into their locker rooms, bathrooms, into prisons, is because inclusivity is good. But it seems that this is a double standard, because inclusivity, this is one of the things that really bothers me about a lot of so-called anarchists and a lot of queer theorists, is that they always go on about inclusivity, but they're also the first ones to call a woman who does not want to have sex with a man a Nazi. And so they talk about how we need to be inclusive to include, you know, men in diapers in a pride march, but then they don't want to include lesbians. So it's this inclusivity ends up being a lie, really. Do you want to talk about inclusivity at all? And if not, that's fine.
No, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And it is just another example of the Orwellian language that we're increasingly saturated in. You know, prostitution is empowerment, and now exclusion is inclusion.
And the head of the largest lesbian organization in the United States is a male, by the way.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised.
It's just, it's upside down world.
Yeah.
So what are the, I guess, if you could take the last 10 minutes to talk about some of the lessons for the left. You know, the left is frankly pretty crazy these days, I think. And, you know, I started off by asking about this whole controversy over the Pride March and how it speaks to some issues on the left. And we've talked about them, but can you really bring home the issues that this highlights, such as the erasure of women?
Yeah. Well, you kind of, yeah, I mean, I guess when you say, like, what are the lessons for the left, then my answer to that would be around liberalization again, which has obviously been, you know, going on for a long time. I mean,
now, what does that mean?
Yeah, well, so I'm not a political scientist, as you can tell, but my understanding is that liberalism at the outset was about men, and it's, you know, the founding ideology of the United States, but its proponents were at the time of its founding, you know, slave owners and men who owned women as chattel, as Andrew Dawkins pointed out. But opposed to the absolute rule of the church. And then you have, like, this growing workers' movement and Marxism, which emerged to resist, like, bourgeois ideology. But, and also, you know, things like the commodification of women through prostitution, but not the commodification of women per se, which the suffragists did, fought against, you know, things like fought for rights around divorce and also a marital rape and, you know, later on the rights of women to work and not be relegated into the home and the domestic sphere. And it's really interesting, actually, that one of the things that Emmeline Pankhurst writes about in her biography that the Liberal government did at the time of the suffrage movement in the UK was to establish these liberal women's organisations to kind of to depoliticise the suffrage movement and try and convince women that, you know, they didn't need to vote, they could just be helpmates in men's politics. And then,
oh, there's no lesson in there at all for today, is there?
But yeah, I feel like we're suffering from the consequences of that now, because, you know, we've had this liberalization since, you know, the McCarthyism in the 1940s, when, you know, the real kind of diehard, well, people who were identified as communists purged even from, you know, the unions, and then the 1980s. I know that the unions in New Zealand started to accept capitalism and neoliberalism a lot more, because it was our Labour government that neoliberalised New Zealand, and so the unions didn't want to stand up to them, because then they risked having the national government, conservative government, come in. And that's just been this... There's just been this chipping away at these kind of baselines of leftist beliefs and activism. And, you know, like, one of the things that first happened, I think, that was, you know, and one of the significant things that happened in New Zealand as a result of some of that, you know, in 1998 was the International Labour Organization that was briefing governments about decriminalising prostitution, and then, you know, that happened in New Zealand, and since then prostitution has been seen, and its decriminalisation and it as an industry has been seen as a progressive thing, a legitimate thing. And, you know, no one's joining the dots that, you know, this whole thing about deregulation of industry for the sake of profit is exactly what neoliberalism is, and slowly as these narratives about promoting you know, prostitution as work and everything start to kind of really infiltrate and capture the left, it's, you know, people who join the left and have been participating in the left as unionist, or, you know, so even in these prison abolitionist groups have started to adopt and promote these narratives, and it's basically like, you know, waving the flag, like, surrender, you know, you're just not a leftist anymore. And so, yeah, I feel like this process of liberalisation, which I've kind of, I know I'm a bit unwieldy in my I'm ranting, but yeah, I mean, in summary, like, to me, it just seems like what we're seeing at the moment with this trans activism and this promotion of prostitution is really like it's like the completion of a project that to liberalise the left that's been going on for quite a while, and I think the left needs to wake up to that.
I keep thinking about how Andrea Dworkin talked about how, she said it better than this, but basically conservatives perceive women as private property and liberals or lefties perceive women as public property. And the whole push by the left, you know, the pushing of prostitution, the pushing of pornography, and the pushing of the very definition of what it means to be a woman is now the definition is now public property, that any man can be a woman by simply declaring himself to be so, and that's now public property as well. So it seems she was very prescient when she wrote that.
I've heard that before, and I think to me, I think the left or liberals, I mean, they're hard to tell apart these days sometimes, but allow themselves even more hypocrisy than that, because with this, you know, to me, the whole idea of liberalism is based on the idea of rejection of the church and, you know, God as divine authority, and instead this notion that all men are kind of rational actors. To me, then, you know, you're particularly advocating for men who are opposed to the church, and so, you know, who are persecuted by the church. But so now what we're seeing in this liberalized left is basically the justification as rational of any actions carried out by men who are not served by the conservative right. And what that means to me is that a whole lot of contradiction, because these men don't agree with each other. So, you know, when you talk about women being seen as as public property. And, you know, like, that's a nice characterization, but at the same time, you know, if you go around accusing people of Islamophobia, and you're therefore defending Islam, it's definitely, I mean, you're neglecting to, you know, look at and critique practices like the compulsory hijab, which is very much about marking a woman as a private property. And so, you know, I just feel like the liberalized left at the moment is allowing itself so much contradiction and hypocrisy so that it can remain a political home for every man who's not served by the conservative right. And as a result of that, it's going to keep going through these, you know, phases like what's going on in New Zealand at the moment, where there's this kind of just implosion, and, you know, all these people are getting drawn into this conversation because there's something happening with pride that's kind of making it hard for people to stay out of it. And as they get drawn in, they get exposed because they don't really have any firm bottom lines, and their principles have all sold out. And they've sold out for the sake of, you know, this idea that, you know, anything a persecuted man or a man who thinks he's a victim, you know, anything he does is justified. So I think they need to give up that idea a bit.
Well, thank you so much for that. And is there anything you'd like to close with?
No, just thank you very much, Derek. And I hope I haven't been ranting too much.
No, this is great. So I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Renee Gerlich. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.